Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. We have finally made it to Job chapter 40. We'll entitle this chapter, The Lord Challenges Job. Our context is this. In Job 38, God asked Job some questions to show how great God was. He said, Job, look at the natural world, the stars, the seas, the earth, all the stuff that I made. Could you do that? No, you could not. So why are you questioning me? And then in the next chapter, Job chapter 39, God asked Job to look at all the animals. And the Lord said, Job, could you make all these crazy animals I made? For example, the ostrich. These animals that nobody can even imagine making. Could you do that? No, you cannot. So what are you questioning me for? And now here in chapter 40, God is going to directly challenge Job. So we start now at Job 40, verses 1 through 2. The Lord answered Job, will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who argues with God give an answer. Now in verse 1, the text says, the Lord answered Job. Now, Mr. Benson, the commentator, says that some people say that it was in a still, small voice that God answered Job, not a voice out of a whirlwind. I don't know. I think it's better just to picture God as still talking to Job out of that whirlwind in might and majesty. There's a little problem here because Job has not spoken during the whole last chapter or the chapter before that, for that matter. So how is it that God is answering Job? Well, I think the answer is in how you translate the word answer. Now, a lot of the translations do have answer, but the Cambridge commentator says that it should be taken this way. God took up anew his words and directly appealed to Job. And in fact, the New American Bible translation translates verse 1 this way. The Lord then said to Job, which I think takes care of the problem. Verse 2, will the one who contends with the Almighty, God says to Job, correct him? In other words, you, Job, are trying to argue with me, to contend with me, and you're going to correct me? The NIV says concerning this, quote, a healthy skepticism is good for determining what is true. In Job's case, however, his doubts were becoming destructive as he began to question God's integrity and love for him. Because these doubts were leading Job to believe things that were not true, God wanted to silence them. It is not wrong to doubt if you are genuinely seeking the truth. Truth is unchangeable and will withstand any challenge. So that's a good point to make. The problem here is not that Job is contending with the Almighty. The problem is that Job is starting to doubt God's integrity and love for him, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Now, let me list what Job has never doubted. He's never doubted God's righteousness, his holiness. He's never doubted that God generally punishes the wicked. There is a moral order in the universe. Job has never doubted that God generally blesses righteous people. And he has never doubted that he is innocent of a calamity-causing sin which could have caused all this suffering to come upon him. And he's exactly right about that. Now, when I say Job never doubted the fact that God generally punished the wicked, I emphasize generally because Job did point out that sometimes the wicked do prosper, as we all know, and he also pointed out that sometimes the righteous suffer. He didn't really understand why God allowed that to happen, but he did point that out. But in general, he says, no, God punishes the wicked and blesses the righteous. But now, what was it that Job was beginning to doubt? He was beginning to doubt that God loved him. He was beginning to doubt that God wanted to explain things to him and to communicate with him, both of which were not true. As a matter of fact, God's communicating with him right now, and we're going to see at the end of the book that God did love him. He's going to restore all of his lost stuff. So Job's beginning to doubt that, and God's going to nip that in the bud. At this point, as he chastises Job, it sounds like God is siding with Job's false friends, but we'll see later on, no, he is not. God is not saying here that Job has committed some kind of sin to cause all this suffering. What he's complaining about is the fact that Job is complaining and saying that God doesn't love him anymore, and that God won't give him an answer to his problems, that he's arguing with God. And I think the application point here is no matter how bad things get, do not ever argue with God. Do not ever even suggest that he's doing something wrong. I mean, God is God. You don't tell God that he's doing something wrong. You might be tempted to when everything's gone to pot, but just don't do it. We go now to Job chapter 40, verses 3 through 5. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more. Verse 4, Job says, I am insignificant. Now, when he says this, he could either be admitting that he was wrong, both with respect to his words, how he spoke, and also with regard to his arguments, as John Gill says, or it could be, as the NIV Study Bible says, that Job here does not exactly admit that he was wrong. He implies it. I am insignificant. So Job, if you take the NIV Study Bible's approach, you could say that Job is admitting that he was presumptuous in challenging God. He's an insignificant little nobody to be standing up before the awesome God. But that's not the same thing as saying, yeah, I did something wrong in order to cause this suffering. No, he didn't admit to that. Now, if Gill is right, that when Job says, I am insignificant, he's saying that everything I've been arguing about in the last 39 chapters of Job is wrong. Well, then Job would be admitting to have committed a calamity-causing sin, which we know is not true. So I think Gill's a little bit strong there. The whole teaching about the book of Job would be lost if he's admitting that he's completely wrong, that he's admitting that the three false friends were correct, and that would be a disaster to go along with what the three false friends say. So whatever Job is admitting to here, he is not saying that he was guilty of a sin that caused his suffering. He is saying, I am guilty and presumptuous of challenging your love and challenging you because you won't hear my case and that sort of thing. It's a big difference. Job says, what can I reply to you? Verse 4, I lay my hand on my mouth. That would, of course, to be imposed silence on himself. I think it's the easiest way to take that, although the NIV Study Bible says there was an ancient custom in the ancient Near East to show respect and submission before a powerful ruler by laying your hand on your mouth. I don't know that culture well enough to know whether that's true or not, but I take their word for it. So Job is being very humble here. Verse 5, Job says, once I have spoken, and I will not answer, even twice, and I will add nothing more. Now, this is not easy to understand here. When he says, once I have spoken, that could mean what he has just said about him being insignificant in verse 4, or it could just mean that in the previous 39 chapters, Job has spoken very imprudently and indecently, and he's saying, yep, I did that. I've spoken, and I will not answer. I'm not going to answer for what I've done. I'm not going to say anymore after what I've said, because what I said was wrong. It was indecent and imprudent. You know, Job could defend himself the way he did before men, maybe, but not before God. Now, Job could be saying that I've spoken once without understanding, as opposed to being imprudent and indecent, because Job says in Job 42, verse 3, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? That would be God questioning Job, and Job answers, therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. In other words, Job just got out of his league trying to solve the problem of evil. So, verse 5, going back to verse 5 of Job 40, Job says, once I have spoken, I've already spoken, and I'm not going to answer to you anymore, God, because I spoke wrongly, is what the implication is. And then he says, even twice. That stands for twice, three times, four times, five times. In other words, I spoke a lot, bad stuff, in a bad way, and I will add nothing more. In other words, I'm not going to say anything more because I've screwed up when I've talked in the past. I've questioned your love too many times before in the past. Now, Job, to his credit, has also said that one cannot argue with God. He was arguing with God, but he had come to the point where it's impossible to argue with God. He thought, Job 9:3, if one wanted to take God to court, he could not answer God once in 1,000 times. Job 9:15, even if I were in the right, I could not answer. I can only beg my judge for mercy. So he admits that it's a pretty awesome thing to argue with God, and no, you're not going to argue with him. So although he says he's not going to argue, and he says that it's wrong to argue, he did argue with God all the way through the book of Job. We go now to Job 40, verses 6 through 8. Then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind. Again, I think that the voice continues to come from the whirlwind. It's not going from the whirlwind, then a still small voice, then back to the whirlwind, as some people say. Verse 6, then the Lord answered Job from the whirlwind. Verse 7, get ready to answer me like a man. When I question you, you will inform me. Would you really challenge my justice? Would you declare me guilty to justify yourself? Now the question arises, why would God continue to rebuke Job? Job has already said he would be quiet, as we just read in verses 4 and 5. I will add nothing more, Job says. I'm finished. But God goes on. God doesn't say, well, thank you, Job. Thank you for saying that I was right and you were wrong. No, God goes on a good bit more. Why? Well, it could be because Job had not really repented. He says, I'm not going to say any more. He said, I'm insignificant. But that's not really saying, I'm sorry, God, I did it. That's not the same thing. It's getting there, but it's not there yet. Job didn't explicitly repent until chapter 42, verse 6, when he said, therefore I, Job, retract, and I repent in dust and ashes. That's when he repented, and so God wanted to get him to that point. And so the thinking is that God kept on rebuking Job to get him to that point. It could be that God wanted to continue with the argument here in order to address the moral issues that were fought over between Job and his four false friends, because God's got to take care of those errors too. Another speculation as to why God continued is because God wanted to convince Job that God would indeed be Job's friend. I'm sure Job has not been convinced of that quite yet. Now, when God has finished rebuking Job over these next several chapters, he started in chapter 38, and he's going to go all the way to chapter 41, 38, 39, 40, and 41, four chapters of rebuke. Well, when we get to 42, then Job repents. So God had to rebuke him, and then Job repented, and that's the good news. That's in Job 42, verse 6, I retract, and I repent in dust and ashes, Job said. Verse 8, God says to Job, would you really challenge my justice? The NIV says, would you discredit my justice? The NASB says, would you annul my justice? And that's by saying, it's not fair, God. It's not fair what you're doing to me. You're not just anymore in the way you treat me. You might be just in general, the way you treat people in the universe, but when it comes to little old me, Job, you're not being just. And God says, would you really challenge my justice? Now, you recall all through the book of Job that Job constantly maintained his integrity. I've listed those verses several times. He never admitted that he did anything wrong because he didn't. And so that, by implication, made God guilty for allowing the suffering. He's saying, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. Major key, minor key. So why are you suffering? Why are you punishing me, God? Why are you making me suffer? The implication is that God is not being righteous, at least in Job's case. As John Gill put it, though Job did not expressly and directly condemn the Lord and arraign his justice, yet when he talked of his own righteousness, when Job talked of his own righteousness and integrity, Job was not upon his guard as he should have been with respect to the justice of God in Job's afflictions. For though a man may justify his own character when abused, he should take care to speak well of God, and be it as it will between man and man, God is not to be brought into the question. And though some of his providences are not so easily reconciled to his promises, yet let God be true and every man a liar. I think that's a great summation of the situation here. Job did not directly condemn the Lord, but he impliedly condemned the Lord when he kept saying he was righteous. And why is he suffering like this? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown sums up Job's attitude this way. Since Job has not only spoken against God, but accused him of injustice, God challenges him to try, could he govern the world as God by his power doth govern the world? And could Job punish the proud and wicked like God punishes the proud and wicked? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown takes it that Job has more directly accused God of injustice, although it really is somewhat indirect the way Job did that. Now in verse 6, where God says, would you declare me guilty to justify yourself? Remember, this is coming from the whirlwind, and a whirlwind symbolizes storm, affliction, strength, power. This is an awesome thing that Job is having to go through here. God says, would you declare me guilty, Job, in order to justify yourself? Now, how had Job declared God guilty? Two ways, according to the NIV Study Bible. The first way was, Job thought that God had wrongly allowed Job to suffer without cause. We see that in Job 19, verse 6. Job says, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. Now, that doesn't sound too much like an implied attack at God's injustice. It sounds more direct than implied, although John Gill says Job did not expressly and directly condemn the Lord. I read this verse, Job 19:6, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. That sounds like Job has directly condemned God's justice for causing him to suffer. Now, he didn't do it to God's face. He did it to one of the false friends, but nonetheless, he publicly did that. So anyway, that's the first thing that God says, Job, you have declared me guilty because you say that I was wrong to allow you to suffer without cause. The second way that you have declared me guilty and wronged me is that you, Job, felt that God had not given you your day in court in order that you, Job, might be vindicated. We read that in Job 9, verses 32 through 33. Job says this, For he, for God, is not a man as I am that I may answer him, that we may both go to court together. There is no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both. Job is complaining because he doesn't have a court to go to where he can haul God into court and say, What's going on here, God? Why are you punishing me like this? So Job said that God had wronged him, caused him to suffer without cause, and two, had not given Job a day in court. And he is now being rebuked for those two errors. We go now to Job 40, verses 9 through 14. God continues speaking to Job. Do you, Job, have an arm like God's? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Rhetorical questions. Answer, no. Verse 10. Adorn yourself with majesty and splendor, and clothe yourself with honor and glory. Unleash your raging anger. Look on every proud person and humiliate him. Look on every proud person and humble him. Trample the wicked where they stand. Hide them together in the dust and imprison them in the grave. Then I will confess to you that your own right hand can deliver you. This is God pulling rank on Job and saying, Job, you are a nothing burger. You can't do anything like this. You don't have an arm like me that I can, with power, do anything I want to. You can't make it thunder like I can. So why don't you go ahead and dress yourself with majesty and splendor like God? Can you do that as you pick your boils? Clothe yourself with honor and glory as your wife abandons you and your friends curse you and say that you're a pathetic sinner with no reputation anymore. Let's see you do that. Verse 11, unleash your raging anger like I, God, can do when I get angry at sinners in the world. My raging anger comes upon them in punishment. I look at proud people and I humiliate them. Look at Napoleon at Elba. He's pretty humiliated. Look at all the communist dictators. They're gone. Mao Zedong huddling at Zhongnan High right next to the Forbidden City as he suffers with Lou Gehrig's disease and as he runs out the clock on his miserable existence. God takes care of these people. He tramples the wicked where they stand. Can you do that, Job? Verse 13, can you hide them together in the dust, imprison them in the grave? And what he means by that is, can you bury them, hide them together in the dust, which is parallel with imprison them in the grave? Parallel meaning the same thing. Can you put them under the ground, Job? I can kill people when I want to judge them. Verse 14, if you can do all that, Job, then I, God, will confess to you that your own right hand can deliver you. If you can do all that, then say, okay, Job, you could deliver yourself from your sufferings. And so God points out to Job, there is no way that you're going to get out of this suffering without me. This is a little rough, considering what Job's been through. God's being sarcastic with Job here. Adorn yourself with majesty and splendor, Job, as you sit there in the dust picking your boils and your scabs. One translation note here in verse 13, God says to Job, imprison them in the grave, talking about wicked people. Let's see if you can put them in the grave, imprison them in the grave. The NIV translates that as bury them all in the dust together, shroud their faces in the grave. That word shroud there refers to the custom of binding a cloth over the faces of persons about to be executed. Kind of like when Julius Caesar got stabbed on the Ides of March. What did he do? He pulled his cloak over his head like a shroud. We go now to Job 40, verses 15 through 18. God continues speaking to Job. Job, look at Behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. Look at the strength of his loins and the power in the muscles of his belly. He stiffens his tail like a cedar tree. The tendons of his thighs are woven firmly together. His bones are bronze tubes. His limbs are like iron rods. Now, this is the famous passage referring to the monster Behemoth. There is a lot of dispute as to which animal this Behemoth was referring to. I just read in one commentator where it claimed that Behemoth was a crocodile. I think the two most often cited candidates for Behemoth are the elephant and the hippopotamus. Some people say it's a mythical creature, or at least an extinct creature that nobody knows what it is today, but Job knew what it was back at his time. I remember one of my favorite movies as a grade school child. My mother took me to see this horror movie called The Giant Behemoth. I love that movie. It was one of these typical Japanese horror movies, cheaply made. But for some reason, that thing grabbed me as a little kid. If I remember correctly, it looked an awful lot like a brontosaurus. You know, these dinosaurs are extinct now. Who knows what was there during Job's time? I don't know. But I'm going to just assume, I'm just going to think as we go through here, it's a hippopotamus. The NIV note says that behemoth is possibly the hippopotamus or the elephant. John Gill says it's either a hippopotamus or an elephant. But Adam Clark shares his doubts. He says this, comparing the characteristics between these two, hippopotamus or an elephant, the balance is considerably in favor of the hippopotamus. But even here there are still some difficulties, as there are some parts of the description which do not well suit even the hippopotamus. And therefore I have my doubts whether either of the animals above is that in question. Either of the animals, hippopotamus or elephant, is the animal in question. Or whether any animal now in existence be that described by the Almighty. Well, it seems like the preponderance of opinion is this animal is a hippopotamus. I'll go with that. Jameson Fossen Brown points out the difficulties that Clark also pointed out. The description in part agrees with the hippopotamus, in part with the elephant, but exactly in all details with neither. As we go through here, I'll point out some of the descriptions don't fit one animal or the other. Both John Gill and Jameson Fossen Brown say that this behemoth is an unknown extinct animal. Well, let's look at behemoth. The first thing in verse 15 about behemoth, he eats grass like an ox. Now, a hippopotamus lives in the water, but he eats grass. This is a marvelous thing, as James Fawcett Brown say. It's strange that such an animal as big and strong as a hippopotamus would not be carnivorous. Well, that could be, the reason for that could be, is that God is describing marvelous or strange, weird things in nature to show that only God could do something this crazy, not you, Job. Remember in a previous chapter, he talked about the ostrich, how dumb it was, little wings, tried to fly, couldn't fly, but he had legs like a horse, can get out and run a horse. Remember that? And the point there was, Job, you couldn't make something as wild and crazy as an ostrich. So I think that's what he's doing here. This hippopotamus, or this behemoth, eats grass like an ox. Verse 16, look at the strength of his loins and the power in the muscles of his belly. Now, the belly is the weakest part of an elephant, so this passage here tends to show that the elephant is not what was meant by behemoth. The strength of his loins, the power in the muscles of his belly. That sounds like a hippopotamus. I'm not an expert on hippopotami, but if I were crazy enough to get under one, I suspect that I would see a lot of muscles. Verse 17, behemoth stiffens his tail like a cedar tree. That also cuts against the animal being an elephant, because an elephant has a curly tail like a pig, as Adam Clark points out. Now, that tail could be translated trunk. He stiffens his trunk like a cedar tree, in which case that would fit an elephant. So that's not a slam dunk argument against an elephant, but it tends to make you think that behemoth is not an elephant, because an elephant doesn't have a tail like a cedar tree. It's got a tail like a pig. The tendons of his thighs are woven firmly together. That just shows the strength of his legs. Verse 18, his bones are bronze tubes. That doesn't fit an elephant too well either, as John Gill points out, because an elephant's bones are for the most part light, porous, and spongy. I assume Gill knows what he's talking about. I don't know a thing about elephant bones. His limbs are like iron rods. Well, as you can see here, if you had to bet your life on it, this behemoth is a hippopotamus, not an elephant. And Jameson Fawcett Brown says that the description does not fit in all the details exactly with both animals. Well, I've showed you how it doesn't fit with elephant, but I don't see where it doesn't fit with a hippopotamus. Well, let's move on. We might find out something else as we go on. Talking about behemoth, Job 40, verses 19 through 24, and we will finish this chapter. He, the behemoth, God continues speaking to Job, the behemoth is the foremost of God's works. Only his maker can draw the sword against him. The hills yield food for him, while all sorts of wild animals play there. He lies under the lotus plants, hiding in the protection of marshy reeds. Lotus plants cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Though the river rages, behemoth is unafraid. He remains confident, even if the Jordan surges up to his mouth. Can anyone capture him while he looks on, or pierce his nose with snares? Verse 19, the behemoth is the foremost of God's work. That is not counting men, of course, because mankind is really the foremost of God's work. But he's talking about animal works here. He's right up there. Only the behemoth's maker, i.e. God, can draw the sword against the behemoth. as the NIV translates, the behemoth ranks first among the works of God, yet his maker can approach him with the maker's sword. The hills yield food for him. The hills are covered with grass. A hippo can eat grass. Remember, he's not carnivorous. Clark thinks this is improbable that a hippopotamus would wander all the way around of the hills to eat grass. Clark says, this behemoth cannot therefore be the hippopotamus, as he is seldom found far from the rivers where he has his chief residence. Well, Adam Clark knows everything about animals, but I don't know if he knows everything about hippopotami. I can see a hippopotamus wandering up to the hills to get some grass. Well, this wandering to the hills impels Clark to say that this behemoth is an extinct animal. We'll assume the hippopotamus goes to the hills where all sorts of wild animals play. So on the mountains, there's all sorts of wild animals playing there. Why do they not run when the hippopotamus comes? Or the elephant? Because if it's an elephant or a hippo, an elephant and a hippo are both vegetarians. They're not carnivorous. They're not going to eat the wild animals that are there, so the wild animals stay there and play. Verse 21, the behemoth lies under the lotus plants, hiding in the protection of marshy reeds. And that sounds more like a hippopotamus than an elephant to me. Now, having lived in China for so long, I have seen so many ponds covered with lotus leaves, phoenixes, and lotuses. That's all you hear about in China, over and over and over again. That and harmony. Well, and the yin and the yang. Well, lotus, I have seen so many ponds with lotus trees, and all a lotus is a big weed. It's got pretty flowers on it, I know, and it's used a lot in Chinese pottery, and it's beautiful and all that. But if you look at lotus long enough, there's these huge green leaves, and they cover the water, and you can't see the water under the lotus leaves. So pretty soon, they got to be cleaned out. Well, if a hippopotamus got under a lotus plant, he would be completely covered. Or if he got into the marsh by the side of a river where the reeds are, he can hide in the reeds. Verse 22, lotus plants cover the behemoth with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Again, the idea that this animal is around the water, which is more true of a hippopotamus rather than an elephant. Verse 23, though the river rages, behemoth is unafraid. He remains confident, even if the Jordan surges up to his mouth. Now, this is a strange verse to me. The Jordan River? What does Job know about the Jordan River? Or the author of Job? Well, Job operated between the Jordan River and the Euphrates River, so he would know about the Jordan River. But the problem with referring to the Jordan River is there's no hippopotami in the Jordan River, and there's no elephants in the Jordan River. Most of the translations have the Jordan River. I was wondering if maybe it's a translation issue. I did find one translation that does not use the Jordan River. Let me read that for you. This is the New American Bible, Job chapter 40, verse 23. If the river grows violent, he is not disturbed. He is tranquil, though the torrent surges about his mouth. Not the Jordan, but the torrent surges about his mouth. Now, the pulpit commentary, the Poole, Matthew Poole and John Gill, they say that the Jordan here probably stands for any large and strong flowing river, not the Jordan River in particular. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says the Jordan River here is a, quote, poetical generalization. Jameson Fawcett and Brown say the author could not have been a Hebrew because there were no river horses, no behemoths in the Jordan, as I've already pointed out. So this could be a hypothetical statement that the Jordan River might surge up into this behemoth's mouth, especially if it's a mythical creature. Or if it's an extinct creature that was wandering around in the Jordan, I don't know. But I tend to want to take this as saying that this is just a general statement for a surging river. Doesn't scare the behemoth, the surging river. Water comes all the way up to his mouth. He just puts his little eyeballs up above the surface of the water and looks at you. He's not worried. Can you do that, Job? Verse 24. Can anyone capture him? This is God speaking, continuing. Can anyone capture behemoth while behemoth looks on or pierce his nose with snares? No, you can't. Again, God is trying to show how great he is. Translation issue here, verse 24, Holman Christian Study Bible. Can anyone capture him while he looks on? The NIV translates it this way. Can anyone capture him by the eyes? In other words, putting a hook in his eye or pierce his nose. In other words, you can catch him by the eyes, you can catch him by the nose, but you're not going to be able to do it. NIV marginal note says, can anyone capture him by a water hole? Minor translations differences don't make a hill of beans of difference as to how we interpret this chapter. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Job chapter 40. The Lord has challenged Job. You're not me, Job. You're not God. You spoke too soon. You spoke impetuously, imprudently, indecently. You accused me of things that you should not have accused me of. You accused me of not giving you a hearing. You've accused me of wrongly allowing you to suffer without cause. And by the way, we should mention that the reason that Job suffered was because God was not trying to destroy him or make him miserable. God was trying to test him to make him stronger, in his love for God, and to show that the devil was wrong when the devil was saying the only reason he loves you is because of all the good things you do for him. Another reason that God allowed the devil to test Job so severely is so that the book of Job would be written, so that you and I and millions of people in the millennia that have passed since this suffering, we can gain comfort through the suffering of Job and realize that God loves us even in the midst of our suffering. So ladies and gentlemen, we finished chapter 40 of Job. That prepares us to go to Job chapter 41, verses 1 through 34, and we will look at the famous Leviathan, another monster. We've taken care of the behemoth in this chapter. Now we're going to look at the great Leviathan in the next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.